Committee on Revenue for April 11, 2007 will come to order. We have four public hearings and one possible work session scheduled for today. And I would like to open the public hearing on House Bill 3482. Paul.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3482 modifies the statute regarding the Oregon Facilities Authority. It expands the authority's list of institutions eligible for financing, and it increases the membership of the authority from 5 to 7 and specifies they serve at the pleasure of the treasurer. We do have a dash one amendment that adds an emergency clause and has some additional language in it. And we also have Representative Bonamici here and the treasurer here to talk about.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Bonamici, representing House District 34 in Washington County. Thank you so much for holding this hearing on House Bill 3482, which I sponsored along with several co-sponsors for the Office of the State Treasurer. The Oregon Facilities Authority is a public body that was created by the legislature in 1989, and they help with tax-exempt financing for qualified nonprofit organizations and some public projects. And the financing is conduit bond financing, and it is repaid solely from revenues generated by the projects or from other sources available to the institution that applies. It's all for projects within the state of Oregon for some certain basic types of projects which are in the statute. And as I explained, these are bonds that are paid solely by the applying institution. This bill, House Bill 3482, updates the Oregon Facilities Authority statute and makes some necessary changes so that it's operating in today's date. For example, it changes the membership from 5 to 7 members, changes some language regarding the political party affiliation of board members, which is unnecessary. And importantly, it expands the eligible projects that can apply. For example, under the statute currently, worthy projects like the Oregon Food Bank, organizations like the Pendleton Roundup aren't able to apply, and this would expand the categories that can apply. They would still have to qualify. I am here just to introduce the bill. I'm going to defer all questions about it to Kate Cooper Richardson from the Treasurer's Office and others who are here to testify. I just wanted to introduce it, and thank you all for hearing this bill today.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate your kind and thorough introduction.
Thank you.
Thank you. And given that she's deferred questions, let's call Kate Cooper Richardson, Gwen Griffith, and Lynn Nagasako.
Good afternoon, members. For the record, my name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm Chief of Staff for the State Treasurer, and Representative Bonamici was so kind as to introduce this bill on behalf of the State Treasurer and the Oregon Facilities Authority, which is housed under our office. The members are appointed by the Treasurer, and the Treasurer's staff helps to staff the authority. It does have an executive director, and that's Gwen Griffith here before you, and Lynn Nagasako is the DOJ counsel to the authority. So I think you have in front of you, and probably in your files in your office, and maybe multiple copies in front of you here, an overview of what the bill does. And I'm happy to go through it and give you the rationale behind the changes, Mr. Chair.
I think that's a great idea.
Will do. The language regarding the political party affiliation, I mean, frankly, I don't know the whole story behind this, but I think there were some deals struck originally when this was created. It has been an awkward thing for the treasurer to sometimes have to ask people's party affiliation before appointing, and it doesn't have any relevance to the work of the board. And so the authority and the treasurer have agreed that that's not a provision that needs to remain anymore and might even leave a false impression about the nature of this board. It's it's pretty non-political work we do. So that is one, that's the rationale behind removing that requirement. It's not a requirement of very many other authorities, and certainly not of authorities that do the sort of work that the Facilities Authority does. The second change is just clarifying that members serve at the pleasure of the state treasurer. This may have been a drafting omission originally, but the treasurer is the appointing authority, and you would think that he can also remove or, and that's probably implicit, but while we're doing everything else, we thought we would make this clear and use language that is used in other statutes for other boards and commissions. One reason we wanted to expand the membership of the authority from 5 to 7 members, this is actually a pretty busy group. They meet monthly, and that is, as you know, since you are all busy people, and these are busy people who also serve on the authority, that can sometimes cause problems as far as getting a quorum when you have a small membership. So we would like to expand that membership to 7, and we're hoping also that that will increase the opportunities for diversity on the board, geographically, and also by experience as well. Then expanding eligible projects to include all qualified 501c3 organizations. I'll let Ms. Griffith speak to that more directly because the authority is expanding its work to reach all nonprofits, and in fact creating an express bond program for them. The list of eligible institutions is already pretty broad, and the authority wanted to expand the scope here so that we can execute the policy that the legislature has put before it. And then the last, if you have any questions about this, I will defer this to our DOJ counsel, but it modifies the language, clarifying that OFA can execute contracts and spend funds for management of its affairs. I think the original language was not entirely clear and could be interpreted different ways, so we wanted to make sure that it wasn't limited so much that the authority couldn't execute its duties. There is also an amendment before you, a -1 amendment, and that's because, you know, this relates to issuing bonds, and anytime you have issuing bonds, the bond councils get a hold of the bills, and you have to have very precise language, and so that's pretty much what we've got here. The emergency clause, I did want to address that. Two reasons for that. One of them is that we'd like to expand the membership of the board as soon as possible because we are picking up with the express bond program, and we'd like to bring as many people on board early in that process as possible. Second, because we are working with this express bond program, folks are very excited as we're building up, and there are some organizations that would like to take advantage of it as soon as possible, and I think you heard Representative Bonamici mention Pendleton Roundup. But the way the timing of their projects are, the sooner the better. So with that, unless you have any questions for me, I'd like to pass it over to Gwen Griffith. I was trying to talk fast because this isn't that exciting of a bill. Gwen Griffith, so she can go over this with you as from the authority's point of view.
And I think we'll hold questions until we've heard from all three of you, because one of you may answer the question that we're thinking about. Please.
Very well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Griffith. I'm the Executive Director of OFA, the Oregon Facilities Authority. It is the statewide agency in Oregon that facilitates the issuance of tax-exempt conduit revenue bonds, and there will be a test on that later. OFA's role is to work with tax-exempt nonprofits. We receive applications from them. We review them to make sure that the project is serving a public purpose, and we work with the applicant to make sure that the transaction, the deal, makes sense. To give you some sense of what we do, we've just closed a transaction issuing $11 million in bonds to the Guide Dogs for the Blind program out in Boring, Oregon. And this year we'll work with Willamette University and Reed College, as well as Peace Health, to issue bonds for them. OFA is in its 18th year, and it's experiencing a late adolescence growth spurt. We've just embarked upon the Express Fund program, which is designed to allow smaller nonprofits throughout the state to issue smaller bonds at a very reasonable cost. There's been a lot of interest in this from nonprofits, and as a matter of fact, I was on the phone this morning with one who works in Eugene providing services to prevent delinquency, youth delinquency throughout Lane County. Unfortunately, they don't qualify under the current rule. They provide a little housing, a little health care, a little education, but their mission is preventing and dealing with youth delinquency. This bill would expand OFA's jurisdiction to allow this kind of nonprofit. If the bill passes, the authority will have its work cut out for it. There'll be a lot of interest, and it will have to learn to review applications from a wide variety of nonprofits. My board members assure me that they will bring their A game to this process. The structural changes that Kate talked about are fully endorsed by the board members. We are beginning to move the OFA board meetings throughout the state. We'll be down in Medford in July, out in Pendleton later in the year. And we want more geographic diversity on our board. And from a purely selfish point of view, I'd like to get a quorum more easily, and I think that'll help with 7 instead of 5. Other than that, I've given you a portion of the OFA's annual report that shows what our outstanding bonds are. You can get a sense of our clientele. We're excited about the activities of OFA, and on behalf of the entire authority, we urge you to support the bill and appreciate your good thoughts about it.
Thank you very much.
My name is Lynn Nagasako, and I'm from the Department of Justice. And actually, I'm only here to answer legal questions. But one point that I would like to make is that the bill does expand, it makes explicit that OFA has certain contracting authorities. Because when OFA first came into existence, there was really no infrastructure created. There was no staff. There was no executive director. And so in order to put together that infrastructure, DOJ struggled and found the implied authority within the statute to create this infrastructure. Now we would like to make it very clear that OFA does have that authority. Thank you.
And that's sub E on page 5, or is it? Well, actually, there's other provisions as well. It looks like you're repealing several subsections and adding some small letter subsections to put this into effect.
Actually,
have I got that right?
It's on page 4, section 4. Mm-hmm. That relates to section 289.110. The original language, the introductory language to that provision says that it's related to eligible projects, and we've taken out that language to broaden the breadth of that provision.
The rest of the amendments, Mr. Chair, I think are primarily restructuring.
Stylistic.
Yes. Okay. I was trying to figure out what the differences were, and I wasn't finding them.
Well, I had a heart attack first time I saw it.
Right. So the main difference is leaving out the language in relation to an eligible project on line 36 of page 4. Is that right?
Right. And there's also, let me see. And on E, on page 5, line 25 or 26, we changed the word granted by this section to granted by this chapter, so it's clear that it covers the whole authorizing mm-hmm. statute of OFA rather than just this specific section.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you very much for coming forward. Gwen, thank you for taking over after Bill Love for many years of good service. I seem to recall that we attempted once previously to put in the food banks into the OFA, and we had a problem with it. Did we just not do it right? That was 3 sessions ago. that we were trying to do that. We added at that time mental health facilities, and we did some other cleanup of it, but we tried to get at the same time the food banks. That's no longer a problem, evidently.
Well, it is a problem under the current statute, but it would not be a problem under the statute as amended by this legislation.
So we're going to get done what you thought you were doing before.
Great. Excellent.
Is that right?
That's right.
Other questions?
I had some follow-up questions, if I may.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. It's my recollection that these do not qualify as municipal bonds of the state because they are for specific projects, or will some of them, if they are used for nonprofit exclusively, qualify for the state's nonprofit muni bond rating?
The bonds that OFA issues are all municipal bonds. And I guess it's the purpose of the legislation is to expand eligible projects. All our borrowers are nonprofits, but they have to fall into certain buckets of activity, like higher ed, health, housing. And food bank just didn't fall into one of those categories.
May I modify your question just a little bit? My understanding of this rule is that the federal government allows certain kinds of things to be tax exempt. That we were attempting, at least in one category, to do something that would allow for that and also, of course, make them tax exempt in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Would you describe that a little bit? I mean, I think that's what the introduction to this proposed changes is about. If one of you could just talk a little bit about the theory behind this, I think that might answer both Representative Butler's question and mine. And if that's too vague, I'll try again.
Maybe the Laura Lockwood and Paul might have an answer, too.
I'll give it a shot, and feel free to interrupt if I'm getting off track for you. The state treasurer issues these bonds upon OFA's recommendation, and they are tax-exempt bonds. They are eligible for the lower tax-exempt rate because the underlying obligor is the tax-exempt nonprofit entity. This is good because they get a lower financing rate, and every dollar they save in financing, they can put to providing services. So all of OFA's bonds are these tax-exempt bonds. This does not change anything with respect to that. It simply makes the larger universe of 501c3s eligible on the theory that there is no good reason to distinguish between them. A housing organization and a youth services organization seem pretty similar in terms of public good.
There is something about these bonds, though. I think they do not qualify under the AMT. There's some other issue that deals with this, where these are I recognize they're not GO bonds, but they're revenue bonds or conduit bonds. But my concern is, do they still come in at a very preferential rate, even though they do not qualify for the AMT and the other kinds of exclusions?
Yes, they do. They're a big benefit for the nonprofits that are the obligors under them. We really have a number of different rates that they enjoy. The Express Bond Program is a little bit higher than the interest rate one would get in a public offering. However, it's still better than what the taxable borrowing rate is.
And just one addition is that OFA does issue some taxable bonds. And, for instance, you might have a project where some of the costs are not eligible for tax exempt. So the majority of the bonds are tax exempt, and a small portion would be taxable.
Okay. And that's based on federal law, isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
A couple more follow-ups.
Yes.
The current geographical representation of the five-member board, do we have folks from all over the state?
We have one member from Pendleton, one member from Eugene, and two members from Portland.
And a current vacancy.
Okay, and then one final question with regard to the operations. As I recall, we still had one default the last time I looked at your list. How many defaults do we have, or anyone in arrears right now with regard to your portfolio?
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay, there's no one in arrears?
Not that I know of.
We don't have a museum on a campus anywhere that's...
I think that was wound up.
Oh, okay.
But in any case, the state is not on the hook to pay these bonds.
The state is not on the hook. If there is a problem with the bond, and we do have from time to time letters coming in saying someone is there is a bond with issues, and because there's usually credit support with these bonds, then you see the letter of credit people, the bond insurers, and everyone stepping in to work that out and make the transaction smooth.
Okay, I had one final question. A representative in a district that you used to represent needed to build a gym on a facility, a youth authority, not a state youth authority, but they needed to build a gym, and the gym was only going to be $495,000. They had grants for everything else. They needed $495,000. It was under $500,000. And contacting Bill Love, he said, you know what, you'd be better off to just work out a different rate somewhere else, at a taxable rate somewhere down the street at your local bank, because it's going to be less expensive for you to go through the process with them than it is with us. Is that still the case? Do you have high issuance costs?
Thank you for asking that question. That's a great question, because this is what the Express Bond Program is all about. It's providing the opportunity for a nonprofit to work with their bank and issue a small amount of a bond. Our current guideline is between $500,000 and $5 million, give or take a few dollars on each end, I think. And the costs are a lot lower than a public issuance, certainly, and even a private placement in our regular mode. And so we know, because we're getting a lot of interest from nonprofits who want to issue in the $1.5 million range. And it's very economical for them, seems to make a lot of sense. The bankers are all over this because it's a way for them to provide a lower interest rate to a client that's important to them.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a very excellent thing to do. And looking at the amendments, they appear to be very appropriate. So I really appreciate them bringing this forward today. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I have one. Assuming that we adopt the Dash Ones, is this bill ready to work today?
Indeed it is.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3482? No one's jumping up and down, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3482 and open a work session on House Bill 3482.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move the Dash One amendment to 3482, House Bill 3482. The amendment is dated 3/30/07.
Representative Butler moves the Dash One amendments to the bill. Are there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing no objections, the amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 3482 be engrossed to the floor and moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 3482 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Griffin.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Excuse.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative
Dawson.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative
Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Rosemont.
Aye.
Representative Steele. Aye. The bill having received a majority on the motion is sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any reason why this bill should not be placed on the consent calendar? Thank you. The bill will be placed on the consent calendar, and we'll close the work session. What do we do next? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3265. Okay. And we'll hear from Mazza.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3265, another softball for you. Uh, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3265 is a rewrite of major bonding statutes. Basically, what it does, as you would see from the first couple of pages, that it amends a whole bunch of statutes, basically three chapters within the statutes, rewrites them. As introduces all new different laws into the statutes, and that's almost the first 17 pages of the bill, and then it takes it back to some confirming language for the state section of the bond. So it takes all the bonding authorities and divides them into state section and municipal section or local governments. Introduces that in pages 27 to 39, and then the rest of them will become page 41 to almost page 112 are conforming changes to align all the statutes into two major sections of the ORSs in order to make that. And as you see from the last page and a half, there is a repealing of all, on page 111, whole different sections from the statutes that are probably after this bill no longer needed. However, I understand that there is a lot of change yet to be done with the bill, and we have probably a lot more to listen to.
More to do. Yes, welcome. We welcome State Treasurer Randall Edwards and the commission members, I guess, Lane Shetterly and Wendy Johnson for the commission. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. Before I begin, I would like to just want to give you some good information and good news. Just yesterday, I received notice from Standard & Poor's that they have now moved us into a positive category, which is the next step to an upgrade in our bond rating, and that primarily is the work that this committee did in helping set up the Rainy Day Fund. That's what they cited, and I just wanted to tell you it's incredibly good news, and I, again, have booked a flight. We'll be back there shortly, and we'll hopefully get that upgrade soon. So, again, I want to thank the committee for its work on that effort. So thank you.
Thank you. That is great news. So,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Randall would like to have us go with him back there.
We'll just take the whole committee.
We have work. Unfortunately, we have a lot of work to do between now and April 30th. So.
However, we could do without Andy.
Mr. Chair, we all have light reading on the plane on the way back.
That's true. Red eye, you can sleep with this.
Thank you for that announcement. That's great news.
Yeah.
It will. The taxpayers will welcome that news as well.
It will be a great day for Oregon when we get our bond rating back to where it was, at least where it was before the recession. So, again, thank you for your efforts. So, now to this bill, House Bill 3265. You know, this has been a bill that's been in the making for 2 years now, and hence why we're talking about something that's, I don't know, half inch thick. This was has come out of a group primarily spearheaded by what's dubbed the MDAC, or the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, which only the bond lawyers would love and really are attracted to this group. This is a group that really works at the ground level with municipal financing with local governments and helps advise them and give them some guidance in bond issuances at the local level. And over the decades, we have put in varying statutes relative to bonding authority, oversight, and control. This has been, again, years and years and years, as we all know, of ad hoc, if you will, or maybe not ad hoc, but at least changes in the law that ultimately have culminated in a very complex and confusing statutes. And so, in the interim and at the end of last session, the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, through my office, decided that it was time to go make a change and try to streamline and clarify and, in essence, make this a much more workable statutes for the local governments, if you will, in their debt issuances. And hence, you've got the half-inch thick bill, which, by the way, is going to be amended with about a half-inch thick amendment, if not more. But the point of this is a very important piece of legislation that the Oregon Law Commission took to task over the interim. The Municipal Debt Advisory Commission was part of this, but it was really Lane Shutterly, the chair, which is great to sit with him today. It's been a while since we've sat together and talked about policy, but he and his committee, the Law Commission, did all of the work on this bill, and I want to thank Lane and the committee and my staff for really hours upon hours of meeting which produced this bill. It's an important piece of legislation. It's important because, as we've seen and as you know, debt financing or bond financing is an important part of state and local government. We want to make sure that they can operate in the most efficient and effective manner. This bill will set a precedent and will, in my view, for years and years and years, be something that we can look back and say, yes, we did the right thing for government and their ability to access the capital markets. This isn't going to be a press release bill, I can assure you that, but I can assure you that at the local government level, they greatly appreciate what the work I hope you will do, which is adopt the bill and its amendments, if you will, and set the precedent that this is a much-needed change. I do know that sometimes when you get bills and all these relating clauses, it can be confusing or disconcerting for a committee member. But I can say the Law Commission spent lots of hours vetting this, and certainly that's why Lane Shutterly and staff are here to help you wade through that if you need that today. But I know you'll have a further hearing. Again, my hat's off to the Commission and its work and what the precedent this bill sets. So, again, thank you for letting me be here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Treasurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shutterly here today in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and also, as it happens, chair of the work group that actually put this bill together. So had some personal involvement in this bill. Mr. Chair, it's a great pleasure to be here. I was sharing with Representative Reed, this is one of my two most favorite hearing rooms in the building, this and room 357, where I spent 4 years in the Judiciary Committee. But it feels good to be back, and I do miss Mazin's afternoon dramatic readings.
And Mr. Shutterly, when the amendments come, we will ask him for the amendment.
Mr. Chair, my comments will be very brief because I think Treasurer Edwards largely gave you the overview that I don't have much to add to, except that within the purview of the Oregon Law Commission, the commission was created in 1997 by the legislature to engage in a continuous program of law reform, particularly in areas of broad general interest and, frankly, in areas that often don't otherwise gather a lot of energy behind them, sort of the stepchild issues of the legislative process and of public policy. Having said that, that is not to say that there is not significance in the work that the Commission does, and I think this bill proves that. It is an arcane area. You'll hear from Harvey Rogers, one of the work group members who really does live and breathe this, and Harvey can make this come alive. He can make this exciting for you. But for most of us, this is arcane, but it is absolutely true what Randall said, that this is one of the fundamental building blocks of how we govern both at the local level and at the state level. I learned just enough in my terms on the Revenue Committee about bonds and about public debt to be dangerous in this area. But one thing I did learn was how important this is to the operation of government at all levels. Clearly, one of the issues that the government is concerned about in terms of borrowings and in terms of debt is flexibility, the ability to manage within ever-changing markets, and also cost. Cost being driven in significant part by the complexity of the law and the ability to navigate it and to communicate it and to understand it, both internally among the public bodies but also in the external market and the external world as well. This bill is intended and I think will, with the Dash 1 amendments that will be coming out, greatly enhance our ability to facilitate borrowings at the local and state level at a favorable cost to government, with then the benefits that inure to taxpayers as well because of that. It's been a pleasure to chair this work group of really smart people. Again, learning just enough to be dangerous. I learned enough to call the meetings to order and when to gavel them closed and let everybody else do all the hard work in between. But I've learned a lot in this process, and I hope you will too through your work on this. I do commend it to you. And thank you for hearing it today. Again, I understand this will be just overview. You will have the Dash 1 amendments that will be the substantive bill coming. We all know what the backup was in LC, getting bills out this session, and we appreciate their work in getting as much done as they did. They are in the process, I know now, of finishing the Dash 1 amendments. And so hopefully, before very long, you'll have the opportunity to have the more substantive hearing on the bill. Mr. Chair, with that, with us is Wendy Johnson. Wendy is the Deputy Director of the Law Commission. I'm not sure that what we've handed out is just a summary of the Commission's work on this, the organization of the bill. I think Harvey will be able to talk to you further about that, as well as the need for this reform. And then also you have a printout of the names of the work group members. It was an excellent group to work with, and appreciate their support for the past year and a half in getting this done as well. So I commend it to you. Thank you very much for the chance to be before you today.
Well, thank you. And before I ask for other questions, I don't know whether you actually said this and I simply missed it, or whether I should ask. But the question is, does this bill make any substantive change in the law? Or if it does, are they simply ones that modernize and bring our law into conformance with the custom of the people who issue or talk about or underwrite bonds?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's an excellent question, members of the committee. The charge for the Law Commission was to maintain as neutral policy. That was the guiding star of this, not to engage in a wholesale, broad-ranging policy amendment of government borrowings and bonding. Having said that, every word, especially in this area, has policy implications. So I think probably I will defer that answer or that question to Harvey, who can talk to you. In faith and in fairness, I think the commitment that you should expect would be not so much today, but certainly when you get in the Dash 1 amendments, that where those policy decisions are most significant, that those will be highlighted to you. Again, that was not the intent. It's not the purpose. It wasn't the effort of the work group. But you're right. When you are harmonizing, when you are modernizing, when you are bringing statutes that are decades old into conformance with current law and practice, there are policy choices that need to be made, and we will highlight those for you when you get into that walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I just wanted to put a couple of kudos out there. The bill is 112 pages, and the folks that are listed as work group members volunteered their time. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that the Law Commission has ever been before the Revenue Committee. It's just not an area of law that the Law Commission tends to get into, law reform, so I think that's a significant thing to put on the record. And so I just want to acknowledge the amount of hours. We did start meeting back in 2005 in March, meeting every other month, and then we met every month and then multiple times a month in 2006 to get ready for session. And we are still trying to work out the final points of this area of law, but I just want to acknowledge all the volunteer work and then Legislative Council's significant effort, especially during the interim. Dexter Johnson is now no longer with Legislative Council, but both he and Harrison Conley worked to harmonize these three chapters of law now into two chapters of law to make them work smoothly, and we're still working out those bumps, but I just wanted to acknowledge that amount of work. It's the second area of law that the Law Commission is working on this session that is bridging local government and state government, because both entities are involved in an area of law, the other project being government ethics that Representative Berger has participated on through the interim as well. But we get into both sexy issues and non-sexy issues to try to reform our law. I think this is a good example of pulling the resources together to do an area of law that would not otherwise be done.
I think she means by that it's nonsense.
This is nonsense.
Yes.
Right. Well, the political word is alluring and non-alluring.
Well, given that the issue involves the state treasury, I'm sure the treasurer is right to hear the characterization. Thank you. And may I simply add for the committee that I think we are aware that the kind of help that the commission is giving the state of Oregon is not something we could afford to buy. And the work that people have volunteered to do and lending their expertise for is greatly appreciated. And we want to make sure
thank
that you're aware
you.
Of that.
Yeah,
thank you. Other questions, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you again for all the great work that's being done. And I appreciate the opportunity to just take a quick look at down the list of the people who are at the table. And recognize that this will affect the potentially in the future how we go about bonding on behalf of many kinds of municipal and state activities. The question I had then was, I see the school boards are present at the table, housing community services, I see someone from City Hall in Portland perhaps representing the city's interests, counties and special districts, were they represented? And I just wanted to make sure that we had a broad range of folks, because not that everybody wasn't working for the bonding and potentially good interest for everyone, but were they asked for their input? Thank you, Wendy.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Butler, many of the bond council on our work group list actually do work for cities and counties and special districts, so they were definitely keeping those interests in mind. And I know the counties are definitely following this legislation and are here today. These were the voting members, but there were also many advisors and folks who were following the work throughout the interim.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Your work
Thank
and
you.
For your attendance today. We appreciate it. Harvey Rogers.
So now we have a reference of sexy lawyers versus non-sexy lawyers?
I guess so.
Alluring
lawyers.
Alluring
lawyers. Into autonomous.
Yes, sir.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Harvey Rogers. I'm a partner at K&L Gates. I've been practicing public finance law in Oregon for a little over 30 years. I know you've been looking forward to my line-by-line review of this bill.
We certainly are, Mr.
But you don't get that today. What I'd like to do, with your permission, is give you sort of a high-level view of the bill. We will be back to present it in greater detail when the Dash 1 amendments are available.
Thank you.
Back when I first started practicing law and dinosaurs roamed the earth, the Oregon public finance laws looked very different. Back then, each government had its own finance laws. Shortly after I started practicing, there was a movement to provide laws that applied to local governments and uniformly, and a movement to provide laws that applied to state agencies uniformly. Sometime about then, we made a switch to have the state treasurer issue all state bonds. It used to be they were issued by individual agencies. And then someone had the bright idea that it would be simpler to, when we changed the finance laws, to change them for everybody. So what that left us with was ORS Chapter 286, which was for the state, ORS Chapter 287, which was for local governments, and ORS Chapter 288, which was for everybody. And those chapters grew and grew and grew, and they became sort of like a patchwork quilt. And some of the patches were pretty old and didn't really line up with the other patches, and some of them were pretty new. It became, and while all this was going on, the sort of technology for municipal finance, like most technologies, the complexity was increasing exponentially. So when I first started practicing law, the statutes, for example, would say that bonds had to have coupons, they had to be in $5,000 denominations, and they had to be payable in lawful money of the United States. And you couldn't sell a bond like that now. I mean, they're all computer entries, and there are no coupons, and $5,000 denominations you could do, but it doesn't make much sense anymore. So the whole world was changing, and we kept trying to change the statutes to keep up with it, but they got more and more cumbersome. So as a result of the work group's effort, What you have before you is something that takes the three chapters, 286, 287, and 288, turns them back into two. We have one for the state, and we have one for local governments. Now, under the proposal, the chapter for the state works differently than the chapter for local governments, which you might kind of expect because the state works differently than local governments. When the state borrows money, it does it under direct authorization of the legislature. When a local government borrows money, there's an intervening elected group. There's, you know, a city council or a board of county commissioners or a school board to make some decisions. That's fairly geeky technical stuff, but it matters for how the statutes are crafted. So for the state chapter, we have provisions that that clarify that the treasurer issues at the request of the agency. We have eliminated duplicative systems where the treasurer reviews the treasurer's own issuance of the bonds. If the treasurer is issuing bonds, the treasurer doesn't need to review itself. And we've generally streamlined things. We have given the treasurer more flexible fee authority to allow it to adapt to changing circumstances. And we have a much simpler thing that now just talks about bonds. It used to be that Chapter 286 talked about general obligation bonds and revenue bonds and notes and warrants and all these sorts of things that didn't really matter. So we've tried to simplify it. We tried to make it so a real person could read it and maybe know what the chapter is doing. We've tried to do the same thing for local governments. That's the new Chapter 287, except that it works a little differently because we have this intervening legislative body. Again, the goal is to streamline, to make the provisions in the chapter available to all local governments unless there's a policy reason for them not being available. Because of the historical evolution of the statutes, that hasn't been true. We have eliminated a number of the detailed restrictions on issuing local government bonds and have substituted rulemaking authority for the state treasurer and the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. We recommend this approach because the technology in the finance markets is evolving, and the thing that seems like a brilliant restriction today is kind of stupid 6 months out, and that's awkward for legislatures to address. So that's my quick overview. I would be happy to answer or try and answer any questions you have. The Dash 1 amendments are substantially different. They are not different in intent, but they are different in word.
Thank you. Question, Representative Butler.
Just one question. Thank you very much, Harvey, for your service on the MDAC as a member of it and the excellent work that you've done and are doing. Is the later authority that's been in the last 4 to 5 years authorized to the state treasurer, TANs and those kinds of things? We've done some TANs work and it's been cleaned up a little bit and to follow that. Is that anticipated also, and is it part of Section 286?
Yes. Yes. The substance of the TAN authority, TANs are tax anticipation notes. They are borrowings for the state within a biennium to match up cash receipts to expenditures. The substantive authority that Representative Butler refers to is in the new bill. It looks a little different, and it's a little simpler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions now? I think what you're telling us is that we shouldn't bother to memorize this bill. We should wait until the Dash 1s arrive.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We appreciate it very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3265? Thank you. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3265. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2104.
Ah.
Go ahead. I didn't realize what I was doing either.
Mr. Chair and Committee, House Bill 2104, Ian Gross, comes to you from the House Committee on Business and Labor, and it deals with unclaimed property. What the bill does is to lower the unclaimed property or unclaimed financial property dormancy period from 5 years to 3 years before the property is transferred to the unclaimed property account in the Common School Fund. This would apply to financial institutions, insurance companies, and other companies that have intangible equity ownership. It would also allow automatically for the renewal of property by first-class mail or electronic mail when the financial company doesn't receive notice that the statement is undeliverable. And then it would also...
I'm sorry, I don't know what you just said.
All right.
The first two or three words of that sentence didn't make any sense to me.
Okay. When there's a contact between the owner and the company, when there's like a CD that has a ending date, the company can...
The words were automatically renewable
yes.
property. I missed...
Okay.
I didn't hear the words. Thank you. Now I know what we're talking about.
All right.
Go ahead.
And then finally, it would allow notification by first-class mail rather than certified mail to give notice to the owner of an asset before the financial institution would perhaps impose some kind of service charge or stop interest payments.
Thank you. And we have with us today Jeanette Holman and Cindy Wickham from the Department of State Lands. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yes. Chair Barnhart, good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm the Assistant Director for Finance and Administration for the Department of State Lands. With me is Cindy Wickham. We're not quite that closely related. Cindy Wickham, who is the manager of the Oregon's Unclaimed Property Program. We're here to provide a bit of a background on unclaimed property law in Oregon, as well as to testify in support of House Bill 2104, A.N. Gross. For those of you who are new to the unclaimed property world, unclaimed property is personal property, not real property, and it's held by an entity for a statutorily set number of years when their period of during that period of time they don't have contact with the owner of the property. At the end of that period of time, the entity reports to us the name and last known address of the owner of the property, as well as any funds or securities or whatever the kind of property it is. The origins of the unclaimed property law go back to British common law when any abandoned property, and it was primarily real property then, but real property and personal property reverted to the king so it could be redistributed for the common good. In the United States, it evolved from that common law concept to a uniform unclaimed property law. The first one was established in 1956. We adopted it in 1957, and we are now operating in Oregon under a revision to that law that was made in 1981. There's three major beneficiaries of unclaimed property in Oregon. The first is, of course, the owner, who can go to one place and look for their lost property and claim that property from the state. The business receives a benefit when they turn the property over to the state. They are relieved of any liability in the future for that property. And finally, in Oregon, the unclaimed property law benefits the public schools of Oregon. The earnings on any unclaimed property that we hold within the Common School Fund are distributed twice a year as part of our Common School Fund distribution. House Bill 2104 is really a streamlining bill that we saw some aspects of the law that we thought could make work better for businesses, and we have tried to address a couple of their concerns as we drafted the bill. The first thing it does is reduce from 5 years to 3 years the period for dormancy, as was described for certain types of bank properties. This brings it more into conformance with most other dormancy periods, and many, many entities report more than one kind of property. In this way, they don't have to keep track of 5 years for one kind of property, 3 years for another kind, 2 years for something else. So it brings uniformity to that. It also brings it into line with the period of time for reporting this kind of property in Washington and California. And again, many of the people who report in Oregon are companies that also report to Washington and California. So that makes it easier for them to stay on the same schedule. The second thing that this does is there's a provision in Oregon's unclaimed property law that prohibits a business from assessing a service charge related to either a dormancy or a service fee imposed for inactivity. And one of those actions is a requirement that they provide notice by certified mail. And we're changing that to first-class mail. Again, this saves some money for the entity, but still meets the requirement of providing notice to those owners. We did work with the Oregon Bankers Association while the bill was in the Labor and Business Committee to address their concerns about deposits or time deposits that automatically renew, and to address their concerns about having those, that the change from 5 years to 3 years was sometimes going to cause them problems with those automatic renewals. And that's the amendments that we did that brought you the A and Gross bill. And with that, I'm going to stop and answer questions. And thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Okay. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Just one brief question, and that is the government checks from Department of Revenue, are those handled separately because they don't cheat under the same unclaimed property rule, do they?
Are we talking about tax refunds and things like that, sir?
Any kind of refunds that are issued by the department.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cindy Wickham, the unclaimed property manager. All governmental entities report unclaimed property, and governments are 2 years. The Department of Revenue specifically, after a tax refund check, is dormant for 2 years, sends that money to us, and we actually pay claims on those.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Olson.
Thank you. Jeanette, I have two questions. First question deals with the first-class mail rather than certified mail. Could you explain that again? Because I'm thinking back when the agency I used to work with, we always had to do the certified mail and different things for property. So the changeover.
Chair Reinhart, Representative Olson, I think the change is that an entity could still send it by certified mail if they wanted that evidentiary record that they sent it. But in many cases, they don't need that, and so they can send it by, this just allows them to send it by first-class mail.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
So how do you ensure then that the person that you're supposed to send that out to receives it?
Can I say that?
Chair Barhart, Representative Olson, this is related just to notifying the owner that you may charge a service charge if they don't activate their account. It's separate, I believe, from the due diligence requirements where you need to try to find that owner to get them to reactivate their account. So this particular action is not necessarily one that probably not as important to verify that the person received it as that the entity sent it. They're going to be more concerned about getting that owner to contact them so that the assets don't become abandoned and reportable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. And then yes, Chair, my final question. Regarding dormancy, the change from 5 to 3 years, was that just trying to meet consistency with the rest of the states around us? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, by and large, yes, although I think there's about 30 states, and more the states are moving to this set or a common 3-year period for most types of property. So,
thank you.
If I could add to that also, Chair Barnhart and Representative Olson, participate in the holders of unclaimed property have a national organization where they meet and talk about their responsibilities, and many of these holders report to all 50 states, and one of the things that we hear from them is it's easier for them to be in compliance with the law if there are less dormancy periods. The states get together and kind of have these meetings of the minds, if you will, of what the dormancy period is and what how it's reported. A banking institution right now actually could fall under a 2-year dormancy, the 5-year dormancy, a 3-year dormancy, as well as a 7-year and a 15-year. By taking away the 5-year, we have collapsed that structure a little bit and made it a little bit easier for them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. There are still some of these much longer periods around for some kinds of things.
That is correct. Traveler's checks are 15 years. Money orders are 7 years.
Thank you. And a person who has abandoned property in this way that becomes assigned to you, what do they need to do in order to claim it?
Chair Barnhart, they need to file a claim with the Department of State Lands.
Right. So the fact that you're the depository for the funds doesn't mean that people have lost them forever. It simply means that they need to come and ask you about them.
That is correct, Chair Barnhart, and they can do it at any time. We recently paid a claim for property that we received in 1967.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this conversation, but I want you to know that there was probably nothing more heartbreaking to me as about a 12-year-old boy when my dad took me down with the little savings passbook that my grandmother had opened for me when I was born at the local bank in Vail, Oregon. And she put in $5, and Dad said, "I'm now going to show you, son, the value of compound interest."
Oh, no.
Laid the book out, and you know what happened.
Yep.
They said, "That account no longer exists. We took it years ago." My dad taught me a great lesson that day.
And that's why you're a CPA now.
That's why I won't stick my money in the bank. It's a mattress. It's in these really old traveler's checks.
All right. Now, and Representative Berger was on the committee that heard this bill.
I was.
Before.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Representative Rosenbaum. I'm assuming you heard from the bankers.
We heard from the bankers. They were very positive about this. This helped them. This was well received.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Unless there's something else, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2104? I'm not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2104. And we're down to the hearing on House Bill 3118. Mary is going to introduce that one. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, House Bill 3118, revises the conditions for a person who may file a petition with the Board of Property Tax Appeals on behalf of another, the owner, presumably. And the law really currently is very vague. It lists people such as a relative, a real estate broker, a certified appraiser, an attorney in fact. It could be a spouse. It lists for specific people, but this particular bill doesn't ignore that those people might be able to do this. It's just adding the provision that someone who does represent an owner in this petition to the Board of Appeals will have the power of power of attorney that specifically authorizes him to act on the petitioner's behalf in real and personal property tax matters. So that person could still be a real estate broker or a certified appraiser, but he now has to have some specific authority.
From the person they're representing.
Owner or the person who has an interest in that property and is subject to paying the tax. There are a few other provisions, too. It expands the scope of the board's ability to deny, for a denial, to include its lack of jurisdiction over the petition, which it currently does not have. And it also changes it slightly in the sense that under current law, if the board has to give a 5 days notice prior to hearing, if a hearing's been requested, if that petition fails to meet certain conditions, if it hasn't been written properly or it's in the wrong jurisdiction, they still have to have the hearing and in this case, in the proposal, the board would no longer have to issue a notice of when the petition would be rejected. It would send a notice out, but it wouldn't have to give prior notice of it. And that's it. It's clarification.
Thank you. And I noticed also that it allows for some activities that are required to be done by December 31st to be done by the next business day if the December 31st falls on a Saturday or Sunday. Right. Not a big deal, I think. Huh? And we have one witness for that bill, Jan Coleman, Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm here today with a pretty simple matter compared to whatever else you've been discussing today. I listened to all the financial things and thought, well, maybe this is a good thing to end up on. basically, House Bill 3118 has a twofold reason for being here. The foremost one is really to simplify who can appear before the Board of Property Tax Appeals and represent an appellant. The paperwork I'm giving you, on the second page you'll see a highlighted area, which has actually been dealt with by rule. And over the years, it keeps expanding about, you know, who can represent a relative and who is a relative. And it just kept going on and on and on and so forth. And it's just come to the point where it'd be a lot simpler if we let people, anyone, represent as long as they have the authorization to represent or a power of attorney from a petitioner. This doesn't amend anything in the current law that says that an attorney can do it, or a tax representative, a real estate broker. Those people can still all do it. They all before had, except for an attorney, had to have an authorization to represent. So this doesn't change it for them at all. They still can represent, and it just opens it up to anyone who the petitioner advises or gives authority to do it. Some people just don't have a relative in the state or something that they can have them do this. So we hope it makes it equitable for everyone to appeal. The second part of the provision of the bill really just puts into law some of the things that we've been dealing with it by administrative rule. To the Board of Property Tax Appeals, such as the date, if it ended up that the 31st was on a weekend or so forth, we, by rule, had the procedure of when we went forward to receive and so forth. So a lot of the highlighted areas that you see in the rest of the bill are things that we've been dealing with by rule. As far as the provision about not notifying someone if their petition didn't meet the measure of the law. Actually, by rule, we give them 20 days notice that says you have certain things that don't meet the statute as far as your petition. So you have 20 days to amend your petition. So these people have already had notice, and it's those people that if they didn't amend it by that time period, that we would be actually just not notifying them that their petition is now going to be dismissed. Those are just the basics that I have.
Thank you. A question, Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question as I look at the bottom of page 1 of the bill, on 29 and 30, it removes the person who is duly qualified to practice a public accountancy and adds a lawyer, an attorney filing a petition, must be a member of the bar. Tell me how, again, a CPA, as I read the rules that are given through the other group here, tell me how the CPA then comes back in as a the CPA, PA, or PAs from other states?
Okay. It's down on page 2, line 20. It references up above and says that anybody that has the authorization to represent. So those people fall into that category.
That's actually line 7, isn't it?
Starts 7 through 11 and then includes them.
And then it goes down to there, too. So it...
or any other.
They were specifically named before, and now they just follow into all of the people that can appear if they have authorization to represent.
If you follow up question
yes,
for me, has there been any testimony offered by the accounting community with regard to this or the real estate and appraisal community or the brokerage community?
We in the process of discussing this bill, we have a tech group that meets that's composed of county clerks and representative assessors and people from the Department of Revenue, and we all discussed this. And at the time we came up with the proposed legislation, we did contact those people, sent out the proposed legislation to them, and made them aware of, you know, what we were doing here. And there was some contact back to us. There was concern on their part that they were being disenfranchised, and we go, no, you're just part of the general group now instead of being specifically named. We're not specifically naming so many people anymore. We're just saying, you know, pretty much anybody has authority to represent as long as you have the authorization. And these people had to have the authorization before, so it's not changing anything for them.
One more follow-up, if I may. I don't recall, and I served as a member and as a chair of the Board of Tax Appeals, at a county level, as well as a county commissioner serving on that board. I don't recall that we ever swore anyone to tell the truth on these before these boards. Do they do that now? Because I know that's of concern. Why we had family members, owners, or somebody who had a stake in it, and they could certainly represent their own interests, which we had then discount appropriately or enhance appropriately, as the case may be. But when we had licensed brokers, licensed appraisers or certified appraisers, attorneys, accountants, those folks who are licensed by the state, their licenses were at stake. Do these folks, when they are authorized, does the jurat that they sign indicate that everything that they will present, everything that they will say, will be truthful and that it will be accurate? In other words, if they're presenting a tax return, does it have to be the actual accurate tax return? Could it be a pro forma? Those are the kinds of things that I would be concerned about when we open it up.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler, these people, a bunch of these people have been able to represent in the past for quite some time now. And there is, as a board, the board can have people sworn in if they so desire. That's up to the actual Board of Property Tax Appeals board. My board does not elect to do that, but there could be others that do. That is entirely up to the board themselves. In most cases, if they're people are getting the authorization to represent, it's from, you know, it has to come from the petitioner and the owner themselves. So,
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm. Representative Butler,
I'm going to express a concern, and I hope it can be resolved, and that is this. That when you have attorneys or certified public accountants or licensed realtors, licensed appraisers, those folks, they have a duty of care and obligation. That their statements can't be made flippantly and just thrown out on the table. If the statute is opened so that the owner of the property can have willy-nilly anyone represent them at the table, then we need to take a look at the jurat that they'll be signing, that all of the testimony that they give and all of the presentations of any documents which they provide, because those become part of the public record, including tax returns. When people would say, here's my tax returns from these properties, we say, now wait a minute, before you hand those to us, recognize that that becomes part of the public record. And if your dry cleaner, a dry cleaning establishment, has something in there that you don't want shared with another dry cleaner down the street one way or the other, don't hand them to the board. And so my concern is that the jurat that they sign when they are authorized then to make representations to the board will be done so under oath. And Mr. Chair, I don't expect an answer to that other than that anything that we've received in public record really needs to come from folks that, and this isn't a pitch for CPAs or lawyers, it's just that I would like to make sure that we have the same level of confidence in the competency of the information that's presented. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I would ask, sort of adding on to that, I would ask if the bar has been asked about this bill and whether they have an opinion about it.
I don't know if the bar has been asked about this bill or not. At this point, their position has not changed here.
Well, I'm not talking about lawyers now. When we open, I have the same concern that Representative Butler has, and that is opening up to all and sundry, the next door neighbor and the man down the street, to represent someone before in a legal situation. Where in the past we normally would require an attorney to do that, is a concern. Now, in this situation, of course, we've expanded way past attorneys, but all of the other people are either relatives of the person who's petitioning or people who are either financially, either experts in financial issues, attorneys, or people who regularly work with issues involving land. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of people swearing, isn't there a burden or an obligation in going into a legal proceeding? Wouldn't the person they're representing be liable or accountable if their records were presented or misrepresented? And wouldn't that, and it's just hard for me to imagine that someone would go in and willfully misrepresent. And then again, I'm an optimist.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Gelser. Interesting observation. Other questions or comments for this witness? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 3118 today?
Mr. Chair, I would just thank you, very kind. I'm sorry. I would just like to make certain that we have some folks from those communities that are being pulled off. And I don't mind, again, seeing them pulled off. I just like to make sure that their concerns are addressed. I have had some communication, as you know, from outside communities just to make sure that the records that are represented are, in fact, truthful. And to Representative Gelser, the concern I have is that if a licensed real estate agent comes in and says, I can't sell this property for $380,000. I think that I can get you an offer on it for $300,000 or $325,000, and he or she is telling that to the board at that particular point. That weighs a lot because that person has a license to make that representation. But if the neighbor comes in or a very persuasive friend comes in and says, folks, I'm telling you every day of the week I sell this kind of property and it's not worth $150,000. And as a matter of fact, I've been trying to sell it for $112,000 and have had no offers. That could carry a lot of weight before these folks. These are all just volunteers that are serving on these committees. So I'm anxious that the jurat then say that it doesn't cost anything more to have them sign that says that everything they say and everything they present at the meeting that day or provide for public testimony would be truthful and accurate to the best of their ability and knowledge. And they are representing the people that they're signing for, that it is their representation as well.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the bill? 3118. If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3118. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? I don't believe there is. If not, we are adjourned.